Hello and welcome to the Fletcher Forum podcast. I'm Matt Weinman, the Director of Business and Strategy for the Fletcher Forum. I'm pleased to be joined by Robin Chase, a transportation entrepreneur and the author of Peers, Inc., How People and Platforms Are Inventing the Collaborative Economy and Reinventing Capitalism. She is co-founder and former CEO of Zipcar, the largest car-sharing company in the world. Robin graduated from Wellesley College and MIT's Sloan School of Management, was a Harvard University Loeb Fellow, and received an honorary doctorate of design from the Illinois Institute of Technology. Welcome, Ms. Chase, to the podcast. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So today we're mainly going to talk about transportation and the future of transportation, but I think it might be helpful to start off with a quick overview of kind of the big idea of your book, Peers, Inc., because I think it's sort of in the background of a lot of the conversation.
So my thesis with Peers, Inc. was that there's this new organizational structure that's changing how we build businesses and how we work and ultimately how we shape entire economies. And I would say we have heard about the platform economy and we've heard about the gig economy. And what Peers, Inc. is really trying to pull forward is that there is this collaboration, that platform economies, a platform requires the participation of peers, and a gig economy can only happen because we have these big platform companies. So the three building blocks of the Peers, Inc. collaboration is a platform for participation, leveraging excess capacity, and inviting in the collaboration of others. So the three components: platforms, excess capacity, and peers.
And what do you mean by excess capacity? Because I think some of the other terminology people might be more familiar with, but excess capacity is something.
So if I think about excess capacity, I want people to, I'm defining it as something that already exists, that's already been paid for, but there's more value there. So the most obvious ones that people go to would be, you know, Airbnb and Uber and Lyft. I have my own car that I'm now driving as a taxi, or I have my house, I'm renting out a room. But I want you to think about it in a much broader way. So think about Amazon's platform that used to just sell books, and Amazon said, well, I can sell a lot of other things and then rather than books. Or we can think about cloud computing, that instead of me owning my own server, I'm going to be just renting a server by the hour. Or let's go to another one. Anything that's built on open data, you're leveraging data that someone else collected and paid for. Or a last good example would be smartphones and apps. So every single app that you've downloaded onto your phone, I would think of as the peer. And your phone is a platform in which there's this enormous amount of excess capacity. So you paid for it once, and all the other apps that you're downloading on it are kind of free riders leveraging the excess capacity of your smartphone.
Great. And now let's turn more specifically to the transportation sector. And we've already seen a significant transition towards this sort of collaborative economy. We have, you know, on-demand car services that provide an end-to-end ride, like Uber and Lyft. We have vehicles on demand, like Zipcar or Turo. And I think the question is, what comes next?
Well, we're seeing, of course, the rise of the new word, micromobility. So the not just bikes, but dockless bikes, dockless electric bikes, and dockless electric scooters. And we also, there's a couple of companies, VIA is one, where we now have a new word, microtransit. So VIA doesn't own any of the vehicles, and they aren't, the drivers and the vehicles are all contract, but they're providing dynamic shared shuttles that are incredibly successful in some of the major cities worldwide.
Wow. And what do you think, so there's the micro side of it, and but I'm also curious to talk about the role that automation and self-driving cars has to play.
Right, so let's go to self-driving cars. And then we can also think about automated the implications on fleet of freight, mm-hmm. not just passenger transport. But if we think about self-driving cars, what's really intriguing about them is that we know that sharing really happens most economically where there is density, and so Zipcar will succeed in very specific locations where there's a significant number of people who don't need a car to get to work, meaning they don't own a car. So, and if we think about Uber and Lyft, they work in locations where it's 1 to 10 minutes for the car to come, but it's going to take 20 minutes for a car to come. It's going to be, A, you're not going to want to wait, and B, it's going to be economically incredibly costly because they have to pay a driver for that. So what automated vehicles do is it means that the cost of getting the car to you, a specific location, is now dramatically diminished because I don't have to pay for the driver. And so those sharing, ride sharing or car sharing is now possible in less dense areas. And there's a nightmare side of this low cost. If you think about any business or if we think about basic economics, we talk about the marginal cost. That's the rock bottom price at which you would sell a service. The marginal cost for driving a car, an electric car, is about a penny and a half a mile. Once I've taken your personal time out of that equation, or the payment of a driver's time, it really is a penny and a half to move that car. Which means if we're in a city where people are doing about 20 miles in an hour, it's 30 cents an hour, the marginal cost to move one of these vehicles. That is a terrifyingly low cost. And the implications are that I will use self-driving cars. I, as an individual, will use self-driving cars to be my personal runner and servant to go do any type of pickup I want. And if it's going to sit 4 hours in traffic en route and I'm at work, I don't care. Whatever, it's irrelevant to me. But I want to paint an equally nightmarish figure to the implications for retail and self-driving cars. So if right now your retail is expensive, a retail store is expensive, and the best retail stores are in the most trafficked areas. With a self-driving car, I can now have my retail store in a car that's going to come to you, which means we're going to be turning our streets into warehouses where this warehouse and the inventory is running around on public streets coming to me. And I like to call these RATs, retail autonomous trips. And if we think about RATs in the countryside, we might be fine with RATs in the countryside because there's a lot of space. And I'm not even clear that we are, but we might be. RATs in the countryside could be fine, but we do know that RATs in cities have different implications. And we're seeing and living this today, right now. If we think of the on-demand delivery, the rise of Amazon coincides exactly with the demise of local retail. And so when it's easier and cheaper for me to buy toilet paper, toothbrush and book and have it delivered to me one at a time from Amazon, that means two things. It means there's going to be three car trips to my house, three deliveries to my house, and the retail stores nearby fail because we don't have them. And so I think there's a lot of implications around society deciding what do we value and right pricing roads for any kind of car travel so that we can decide, do we want to congest streets with empty cars, as in me and my autonomous vehicle is running around, or do we want to congest streets with inventory, warehouse inventories of others, but we are already congesting streets with, instead of having one delivery a day by the post office at my house, we'll now see 7 trucks or 10 trucks a day come down the street to my house.
Right. And what do you think is sort of the timeline for that vision taking place?
Self-driving cars, it's interesting. I had made a video that I would recommend people go see. They can go to YouTube and put in Robin Chase self-driving
cars. Yeah, we'll link to it in the show.
I felt that the arrival of self-driving cars was a horizon that was really rapidly approaching. Someone was telling me if something's 5 years away, it means it's never happening or it's not happening soon. But when something starts getting less than 5 years away, that's really is happening. And we saw self-driving cars were imminent, right? It was
right.
So Waymo was doing things imminently. But I would say in the last year, that horizon has started to recede and is pushing back farther out. I do see the rise of another thing that I think will be happening is we have seen, I think it's more than, there's a couple hundred pilots around the world of boring autonomous vehicle shuttles that are going 15 miles an hour on these closed loops in campus-like or certain neighborhoods. And they're, from my perspective, incredibly uninteresting for users, but they are teaching people to see self-driving cars, and they might be giving some tiny pieces of data to the self-driving cars companies. Mm. But what I think we will be seeing, and there's increasing discussion, is there's a type of transportation called bus rapid transit, BRT, and bus rapid transit that exists in cities around the world today. It's kind of like a cross between a bus and a subway, so like a surface subway, and that the bus rapid transit has a dedicated lane, typically down the middle of the street, and they have platforms in which you pay money to get onto the platform, and then when the bus arrives, all the doors open simultaneously. Everyone gets on and off fast, just like a subway. Mm-hmm. And those push through a huge number of people very quickly and are much cheaper to build than subways. So there is increasing discussions that I'm seeing about how we might replace those with automated buses. The giant plus is that buses in high-income countries, the cost of the driver is pretty much the number one expense, marginal cost in a bus. So when you take that out, bus travel, and I would say importantly the frequency of travel, can happen a lot faster. So I think we will be seeing some experiments of autonomous buses in lanes that have been closed and dedicated to them. So from a technology perspective, it's dramatically easier because it's in a closed space, and you know, so you can map it and plan it and have it all out. And I think those will be coming sooner than later too.
And I think BRTs brings me to the next topic I wanted to touch on, which is sort of infrastructure, and especially given your interest at the moment in cities and urban planning, how do we think about the changes in our physical environment that this transition will allow?
If I think about self-driving cars, I've been saying that they will amplify all the bad things that are currently happening in transport. They amplify, because most of the bad things that are happening in transport are due to underpricing. So we've underpriced parking, and we've underpriced, I'd say, curbside touching, the pickup and drop off and delivery that happens. We've underpriced emissions. We've underpriced congestion. We've underpriced the cost of paying for basic infrastructure. When we put autonomous vehicles into that, and I want to say one more, we've underpriced the cost of sprawl. Mm-hmm. So when you build your house out in some godforsaken place, that never is costed, is never priced in there is the true cost of getting you systems and services and education to there. So if we can think about all of the underpricing that's built in right now to our system that's causing us already right now drama, when you put a self-driving car into that system where the economics are dramatically cheaper, all it will do is amplify every one of those bad things that already happens. So what are the policy responses? The policy responses are, we absolutely, positively, I know people don't want to do it, it's not politically viable, we must address our pricing problems now. And I'd say there's benefits to doing it now. If we address these pricing issues now, it'll fix problems that exist now. And it means that when self-driving cars come in, they will come into a properly priced environment and not into an improperly priced one. A second one, so pricing is number one. A second one is, if and where you're too afraid to address pricing, I'd talk about lane reallocation, that right now we're making incredibly inefficient use of lanes. A nice example that I have is, and this is half made up and half real. So in Manhattan, I have a daughter who just had a baby, and I was going by a taxi to get to see her. I was a block from the hospital on a cross street in Manhattan. I was stuck behind and so what does that cross street looks like? It's two lanes of parked cars and one moving lane in the middle. And I was behind a pickup truck, a dump truck, that was loading an entire brownstone into this pickup, this dump truck in front of me. So I was stuck for 10 minutes. And I was thinking, I am stuck for 10 minutes behind this truck. Imagine if it had been me having that baby. Like, right. If I were the one in labor, stuck behind this dump truck one block from a hospital. And why was I stuck? Because 20 people on each side of that street were able to store their cars for a dirt cheap price for 95% of the car. So 20 people are satisfied, or 40 for both sides of that street are satisfied, and that means hundreds of people are not able to use that street as a thoroughfare because we haven't priced it. And so this lane reallocation, to really think about using our lanes efficiently, and that's a nice piece about data right now, is I think we can start making the data case that, you know what, when you're using this lane for car parking, here's the number of people that are happy, and if you opened it up as a lane, here's what would happen. And then we say, what kind of lane do we want to open it up to? Do we want to open it up to moving more cars, which are mostly one person in 120 square feet? Or do we want to open it up for buses or high occupancy vehicle, more than three people, because I don't want to let taxis that are effectively one person in there? Or do we want to open them up for bikes and electric scooters and electric bikes? So to rethink how we use these lanes efficiently.
Are there cities around the world that you think are doing a good job at approaching this reallocation?
There's cities that are.
Or the prices?
Yes. Well, so we can look at the two, you know, famous ones of Paris and London. The Netherlands, they've done serious street lane reallocation. What's totally intriguing to me is in the U.S. right now, and actually in many cities around the world, in the last 3 months, congestion pricing that was totally off the table is now being put on the table and being discussed again, because there really is no other way to address congestion pricing. You know, there's this thing called induced demand when you expand the road, because you can go faster, you just keep getting more people. So we really have to. So I think we're going to see a lot of movement in the next year on both of these fronts, lane reallocation, because of the rise of electric scooters that have a whole different constituency demanding bike lanes, and congestion pricing and technology being at a place where the pain is there and people are willing to take the bike.
And you just touched on in your last answer on using the data that we're able to generate, and you know, you work directly on how to move that data around and leverage it. And so, you know, there's obviously an enormous amount of data about where people are going, where they're working, where they're shopping, that sort of thing. And I'm curious, especially from a public policy perspective, what are some of the trade-offs that we need to be grappling with?
Well, the U.S. has done the most horrific job on protecting personal data. And I want to say I've been yelling at the White House and policymakers for 15 or 20 years now on that point. And here we are today. And so what just happened in Europe, their GDPR standard is good. And I want to say they in Europe are the business community is weeping and wailing in Europe, because they're saying, oh, it's hard, it's keeping us back from building these things. And I would say, no, wait up. We in Europe are now getting our big blow back from our terrible data policy. And so you should feel good about it. I just want to go to transportation, something that's on my mind right this minute that is causing me policy anxiety, and I want to throw out there, is there's a new standard called the Mobility Data Standard, MDS. And MDS was created by LA in the last 5 months, and is being applied to the electric scooters and electric bikes, and then they will apply it also to the TNCs, Uber and Lyft. And having a data standard is correct. I'm completely behind having a data standard, as in, here's what the fields should look like, here's the uniform way we should, what they would look like. But what is also happening that I think is incredibly concerning is that MDS is being applied, includes the dynamic collection of the dynamic movement of the vehicle. So the city of LA is saying, I want to know when you turn on that electric scooter, its exact location through the city, and when you turn it off, and in a non-aggregated fashion. GDPR and California, that adopted that law, has said that vehicle movement lat long GPS data is a personally identifiable information.
Sure.
And LA is claiming that it's not. And so here's my sentence that I would like to pose to everyone is, and your policy question is, I would like to see us get to a base policy question, which is, and in Buenos Aires I got asked this question, and I'm asking my data tech friends, and they asked me the question, what is the transportation data requirement we should have as policy? So they're saying, I don't want to know what the car data policy is, and I want to know what the scooter data. What is the basic fundamental transportation data policy we should have? Because when we think about these scooters, electric scooters, are we saying that if you go into shared transport modes, you have no privacy, but if you stay in your own personal car, wow, you've been able to pay for your personal, your privacy, and you have a different data standard? And that is a slope I don't want us to bring us down to, because if we think of climate challenges, I want everybody in shared transport. And the shared transport ranges from subway up to you're rich and expensive and you're hiring your own leather seat, whiskey closet, taxi. Mm-hmm. But your personal privacy should be protected in all of them. I don't want to have a two standards of privacy, personal versus shared transport. And right now, LA's execution of the mobility data standard that they're encouraging other cities to follow them on is asking for this piece of vehicle location data unaggregated. And so that's a policy fight that I'm taking on right now.
Wow. I think the last issue, and again, you just touched on it, is what this transition and transformation means for climate, because transportation is one of the largest contributors to greenhouse gas emissions in the United States and in different countries around the world. And so sort of how does getting this part of the sharing economy right help in the fight against what is climate catastrophe at this point?
So if we think about reducing CO2 emissions in transport, there are two things that have to happen simultaneously, and there's two different groups of people, I think, that are working on them. One is producing zero-emission vehicles, as in electrification of our modes of transport, and then the second is to get people to either use smaller vehicles or to get more people into existing vehicles. So to have every source of energy, the energy per human transported, to be much more efficient. And we're seeing that happen in two possible ways right now. And I want to say, we just saw the boom and bust of the dockless bikes, which makes me sad. Makes me sad because I think that had we not had so many bikes and the big fight between service providers, I think there was a business model that could have eked out of there. And actually, I want to say from a policy perspective, creating a business model for shared bikes or electric scooters is made more challenging when we don't value the cost of air pollution, of emissions, or congestion. If we put prices on congestion, air pollution, it makes these smaller vehicle business models much easier. But right now, what's really amazing with the electric scooters, who I don't want to have the same thing happen, and it could happen, so we have to really worry about this boom and bust business model, is that data from Portland, Washington, D.C., Charlotte, North Carolina, that have just done their pilot studies, their pilot programs, and then feedback on those pilot studies, is, I'll quote some numbers from Portland, which are just like dumbfounding. The uptake in almost all of these cities of electric scooters is 10 times the uptake of bikes, of shared bikes. So the volumes are just incredible. A number from Austin that I can give you, because I just learned this yesterday, was in Austin, they've had electric scooters for 5 months. There are 300,000 trips a month right now in Austin, which is equal to 10% of what happens on public transit.
Wow.
In 1 month. So number one, people are riding them and they're loving them. And the question is, who are those people? What would they be doing otherwise? in Portland, 35% of the Portlanders and 50% of the tourists in Portland said they would have gone by car. So that is a phenomenal mode switch, like a just mind-boggling mode switch. And why it's wonderful is, oh, and one more point before I make that, is 50% of the people in Oregon had never been on a bike lane before in their life. So the people who are doing these electric scooters are not your healthy, environmentalist, do-gooder, 20-year-old men, white. That's not who's using these scooters. Who's using these scooters? They are also. But a large new population using these scooters are people who would have gone by car and would have loved going by car. And so we have this opportunity to seize on that enormous space and energy efficiency of moving people out of their cars into into scooters. And another number I've memorized, this is my realm, is the 2017 Household Transportation Survey showed that 45% of all trips across America are less than 3 miles. 3 miles is a little bit far to go on an electric scooter, but if we go to dense urban areas, this is a number I'm making up because it isn't out of the survey, is it like 50% of our trips are less than 2 miles? And now you're talking a number that you really could get people out of their cars for. And so what's really exciting and delightful is this is a whole new constituency to say, you know what, I want a bike lane. And so it's another way that we now have a new crack at politically to say, actually, there's a whole bunch of people who want to move into these smaller, more nimble, lighter vehicles that are motorized. Let's make it possible. And cities, there's a whole suite of responses. One response that cities are doing that is a terrible response is we're going to cap them, and we're going to cap them at like 500.
Like 500 scooters across the whole city.
And the problem with capping to 500 scooters is for transport companies, you need some network effects. And if I can never find a scooter, I'm never going to try a scooter. I'm never going to be in a scooter. That's not going to happen. And so I do recognize that the cities are trying to prevent the horror that befell them of the dockless bikes. And so they're saying, oh my God, we don't want to have Beijing had 5 million dockless bikes. We don't want that to happen in our city. Okay, that's a really good, I agree, we don't want that to happen. But a way to prevent that to not happen is to say, is to do some performance metrics, which would be, on average, your fleet of scooters, on average, must have 3 uses a day, which means that you will add scooters to match demand, and you'll be able to grow organically without being able to throw 40,000 scooters on the streets and they're all sitting idle while people grow the demand. So you can grow your fleet with demand, but when you have these hard caps, it prevents the business model, I'd say the demand model, from working. And we don't want that to happen.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We're out of time, but this was a fascinating conversation, and thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with the forum and with the Fletcher School.
You're welcome.
The views shared on the Fletcher Forum podcast are not representative of the Fletcher School or the Fletcher Forum of World Affairs. Music is by Jazar from BetterWithMusic.com.